The Daily Exchange podcast is sponsored by Doucette Survey, serving your professional land surveying and mapping needs in New England, now with offices in New Hampshire and Maine. Information at doucettesurvey.com. That's D-O-U-C-E-T survey.com.
Support for the Exchange Friday New Hampshire News Roundup is made possible by Eastern Bank. We're here, you're first.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. It's our Friday New Hampshire News Roundup. This week at the State House, Republicans selected former House Speaker Bill O'Brien to lead them once again. O'Brien spoke with WMUR-TV on how he'll approach the office this time around.
Well, I think it'll be the same Bill O'Brien, but you'll be hearing from a number of different people. I've always considered myself pretty soft and gentle, and I'm going to remain that way.
O'Brien won't officially become Speaker until the House's Organization Day in early December. Also new this week, a study examining substance abuse from a different perspective, its impact on the New Hampshire economy. Report author and economist Brian Gottlob says the effect is huge.
When you start calculating all the ways in which it has negative impacts on productivity, on the workforce, and the way it directly costs citizens and government money, it becomes believable that it's $1.8 billion.
And more news this week for customers of Fred Fuller Oil after the state's largest provider of home heating oil filed for bankruptcy. Concord-based Rhymes Heating Oils is offering to buy Fred Fuller. The Attorney General's office is watching the sale. AG Joe Foster says it looks good, but it's not yet a done deal.
So like every business transaction, this is a first step. It's a very good first step. We're hopeful and optimistic that it will lead to a closing. But until that occurs, I can't say for sure to consumers that they have nothing to worry about.
It's our Friday New Hampshire News Roundup today in The Exchange, and let's hear from you. Give us a call. The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. The email is exchange@nhpr.org. You can find us on Facebook or Twitter. Our guests for this week's Roundup are Kathleen Ronay, New Hampshire State House and politics reporter for the Associated Press. And Kathleen, thanks for taking time out.
Happy to be here.
Also with us, Jonathan Van Fleet, editor for politics and special projects at the Concord Monitor and editor for PolitiFact NH. And Jonathan, good to see you. Welcome.
Good morning, Laura.
Also with us, Dean Spiliota, civic scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at Southern New Hampshire University, author of the website nhpoliticalcapital.com. And Dean, welcome back. Nice to see you.
Good morning, Laura.
Well, and Dean, I wanted to start right off with politics and New Hampshire's reaction to two key votes in Washington this week. First of all, that big immigration speech by President Obama last night. How did New Hampshire's delegation react to this, Dean?
It was a pretty predictable reaction. Democrats generally support the move. Kelly Ayotte, a Republican senator, opposed it. The issue here is this bill that was passed in the Senate about 18 months ago, a pretty comprehensive bill, and then was not passed in the House of Representatives. So, you know, we heard Senator Shaheen say last night, you know, the optimal solution would be to pass this Senate immigration reform in the House of Representatives and do it legislatively, as we heard President Obama suggest as well. So the Democrats would prefer the legislation, but they're not going to stand in the way of President Obama doing this through executive order. Kelly Ayotte did come out in favor of immigration reform, but she said that the president should not be doing it unilaterally. So, you know, fairly predictable response. I'm skeptical that that immigration bill will be able to get through the House of Representatives in the next session. It was unpopular before, and now we have an even bigger Republican majority in the House. So it's going to be a real difficult haul for Democrats. My guess is that's why President Obama decided he needed to act.
Well, and Dean, again, on New Hampshire, how big an issue is this for the Granite State? I mean, clearly they were watching closely in Texas and Arizona and so forth.
Yeah, you know, we are technically a border state. We don't have quite the same issues as the states that are located on our southern border. There certainly are immigrant populations living in New Hampshire. I've seen a number of kind of anecdotal stories from different communities in the state about how this will impact the lives of families. So certainly going to have an impact up here. Maybe not quite the same as the South, but still something we need to keep an eye on.
Again, it's the Friday New Hampshire Hampshire News Roundup. We're wrapping up some of the top New Hampshire headlines this week. You can join us 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Kathleen Ronayne, immigration was a big issue in our midterm elections that just finished up.
Yeah, it was. I think we saw Scott Brown especially really tried to make this an issue that people could latch onto as part of his effort to nationalize his race against Jean Shaheen. And we did see, quite a bit of anger, I would say, and interest in what was going on at the southern border, especially with the crisis, when the crisis kind of came to a head this summer. So there was definitely a level of interest here. I mean, I think it just it is one of those issues that kind of feeds into overall, feeling of dissatisfaction with the president, or a feeling that, he has not done a good job keeping our country safe. So it's just, in New Hampshire, again, it's not quite as big of an issue, obviously, as it is in a place like Texas or Arizona, but taken as part of a larger, kind of feeling about the way that the country is going. I think that's why we saw people get upset about it and why it was an issue that people wanted to latch onto. Scott Brown did try and make it a big part of his campaign. He ultimately was not successful in his campaign. I don't know if it's, there are plenty of reasons why, I'm sure, but that was an issue that people latched onto.
And what made it so inflammatory was you saw some conservatives, Scott Brown to some extent hinted at this, they started to try to wrap in the ISIS threat through the southern border, Ebola coming across the borders, then terror virus. So it became this sort of all rolled into one terrorist threat, immigration threat, health threat. As you said, it was a big part of the political debate in the midterm.
Yeah, and I think that Senator Ayotte's support for the comprehensive bill also kind of played a big role. There were, 8 senators who had crafted that bill, and 4 of them were Republicans, and Senator Ayotte was one of the additional Republicans who signed on to it. But we kind of saw during the election Scott Brown and Jean Shaheen kind of tried to twist Senator Ayotte's position on immigration, because she's a little bit unique, being a Republican who had favored that comprehensive bill.
And yeah,
they tried to twist
it in the U.S. Senate
into, something that would be better for them, something that they could, be a bit opportunistic about.
Let's take some calls. Again, it's the Friday New Hampshire News Roundup today in the Exchange. We'd love to hear from you on some of the big New Hampshire headlines that we're following this week. 1-800-892-6477 is our number. Roger's in Manchester. Hi, Roger. You're on the Exchange. Go ahead.
Good morning. I just wanted to make a comment. Unless I misunderstood, it sounded like one of your guests just said that he didn't think that the Senate bill that was already passed, that's being held up in the House, would not pass. I think it would pass. The problem is Boehner won't bring it up. And to me, the whole thing is because it's just posturing to make sure Republicans get credit for it, and they know that if they did put it up, it would pass with all the Democrats and some Republicans. I think just for what, it looks good for one or the other, is the silly thing not to pass something that's so important to the country.
Roger, thanks for calling in. Dean, that was you predicting that it would not pass the House.
Yeah, obviously part of the issue is that Speaker Boehner won't bring it up. And in part, he's responding to pressure from, kind of a conservative anti-immigration group of Republicans within the larger Republican caucus. So the issue is going to be whether or not these additional seats that were added to the Republican majority in the House are going to be willing to support immigration reform or not. I mean, Roger's point is certainly a valid one, but I continue to be skeptical that they can actually get that through the House. It may only be a few members of the House. It may be Speaker Boehner. But I think there are a lot of ways in which that bill that came out of the Senate can get tripped up in the House.
Well, Roger, it's good to hear from you. And I'm guessing that they'll be covering this more on the Friday News Roundup on the Diane Rehm Show. But thanks for calling in today, Roger. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange at nhpr.org. Let's take another caller, folks. This is Charlie in Whitefield. Hi, Charlie. Go ahead. You're on the Exchange.
Hi. I just want to say, first of all, I'm glad that even though this is generally considered a southern issue, southwestern issue, that this is being covered in New Hampshire. I think you guys at the Exchange do a great job.
Good. Thank you.
Every day.
Yeah.
My second thing is that as a conservative, by almost any measure, I even I have to say that I liked a lot of what President Obama said last night, as far as not just compassion, but the actual implementation, the actual border security, deciding who to go after, as opposed to trying to actively deport anyone that happens to be illegally in the country. But at the same time, I feel that it was a cynical political move when all he has to do is wait 2 months, and I really do believe they would have had something ready for him.
Yeah.
And so I feel like, you know, a lot of the things that he said, like ripping children from their mother's arm, you know, I think that's a little rich coming from somebody who is very, very, very pro-abortion.
Well, Charlie, thank you for calling in. And boy, this immigration story has the interest of a lot of New Hampshire listeners. I think I'm going to move on from this story now because we have a lot of other New Hampshire headlines to cover. But I really appreciate Charlie and Roger calling in. And again, to you, Dean Spiliotis, another big vote that our delegation chimed in on, the Keystone Pipeline vote this week. We've heard a lot about that. How did New Hampshire's delegation vote?
That's right. And this has been a project that's been in the works for 6 years or so now. Again, predictable votes by our delegation. Democrats voted against it. Senator Ayotte supported it. You know, what we heard from the Democratic delegation are the arguments we've also heard from President Obama. We heard Senator Shaheen say that, you know, we're going to pipe this oil across our territory down to the Gulf of Mexico, and then it's going to be distributed worldwide. We're not really going to benefit from it. There's no real sign that gas prices will go down or that it'll aid New Hampshire in any way. And then we heard from Carol Shea Porter and Annie Custer arguments about the fast-tracking provision circumventing appropriate review of the project. You know, and Senator Ayotte obviously supported it for reasons of economic growth and jobs. There's just a lot of debate about what kind of economic benefit there's going to be. You know, there's general agreement that there's going to be a lot of construction jobs, but after the 2-year construction project is done, it doesn't sound like there are going to be a lot of permanent jobs. So the issues are, you know, jobs, site review, and whether or not this is going to have any impact on gas prices in the U.S.
Well, from Capitol Hill to the State House and Jonathan Van Fleet, Bill O'Brien, not quite officially Speaker, but almost. Let's be clear about what happened this week, Jonathan.
The Republican caucus of the House met. They selected O'Brien as the choice for their next Speaker. And the vote was somewhat close. It was a 4-vote difference, 116 to 112, and Gene Chandler, another former speaker, was the other person, you know, competing for that spot.
And just remind us, Jonathan, the differences between these two gentlemen, especially in terms of style.
Well, people probably remember Bill O'Brien's tenure because it was more recent, and O'Brien was viewed somewhat more divisive and Chandler more willing to work across party lines.
All right. We'll talk more about that after a break. That was a big story this week. We'll follow up on Bill O'Brien possibly returning as Speaker of the New Hampshire House and a lot more stories, too, including a possible buyer for Fred Fuller Oil. All that on the Friday New Hampshire News Roundup. It's the Friday New Hampshire News Roundup on NHPR. I'm Laura Kanoy. We're covering some of the top headlines this week, including how New Hampshire's delegation voted on immigration and the Keystone Pipeline. And now we're looking at some political shifts at the New Hampshire State House. The selection this week of former House Speaker Bill O'Brien to return to the Speaker's post. Kathleen Ronayne, Jonathan gave us the basics there, a close vote between Bill O'Brien and Gene Chandler. But I'd love your thoughts, too. You've been following the State House for a while now.
Yeah, so there are a few. I mean, there are plenty of things that are interesting about this. There was originally a third candidate in the race, State Representative Lori Sanborn. She decided to drop out because her husband, State Senator Andy Sanborn, has been having some health troubles. But basically, that made it so there's only one vote for this to happen because it's a secret ballot vote and somebody has to get 50% plus one to win. So it might have been interesting to see had, you know, Lori Sanborn stayed in the race, there would have probably been at least two votes. And so you kind of take that vote as a chance to kind of figure out where everybody is, who has what support, and maybe it would have changed a few people's minds. I don't know for sure, but it was a very close margin, as Jonathan said. And, you know, as soon as the votes came in, they didn't even announce the count, and Gene Chandler moved to make it unanimous. This is something that the various caucuses like to do so they can come out united. But it does still have to go up for a full vote. The full House has to vote on December 3rd. That means he needs to get a majority of votes in the full House.
So it's not official yet.
It's not official. And there is precedent. In 2004, Doug Scammon was not the Republican Party's choice to be Speaker, but he made a deal with Democrats and won the vote on the floor. So, I mean, there's precedent. Gene Chandler has said very, very firmly that that is not something that he would do. There's chatter around the State House that maybe something, some shenanigans might happen on December 3rd. I don't ultimately know how successful they'll be, but I think that just goes to show what a lightning rod Bill O'Brien has been and continues to be. And we do hear him saying, you know, I think we had him say on WMUR, I'm a pretty kind or gentle person or whatever he said. So he's kind of putting this out there that he doesn't want to be this lightning rod. And a lot of his supporters are saying that's not going to be him this time around. But, you know, you look back on his tenure and I don't even know if divisive is necessarily strong enough a word. I mean, there were a lot of people that did not like the tactics that he used as speaker. Obviously, a majority of the House Republicans think that he'll be a good speaker and they like the priorities that he's laid out. So very interesting dynamic. Ultimately, we're not going to know really until January what kind of speaker he's going to be this time around if he wins the race.
Yeah, and I'd like to ask you about that, Dean. There has been, as Kathleen says, sort of a full court press by Mr. O'Brien's supporters saying, you know, kinder, gentler Bill O'Brien, learned from past experiences. What do you think?
We'll see. You know, as Kathleen mentioned, I had heard some chatter that perhaps Democrats would try to, you know, band with the supporters of Gene Chandler to push him through in the full vote. You know, he obviously threw his support behind Bill O'Brien to short circuit that possibility. You know, it's interesting. It's in some sense it's a mixed bag for Democrats. Although I think on balance, from a political perspective, it'll probably be a useful thing for them. You know, it may complicate Governor Hassan's work on the biennial budget process that's beginning now. But it almost doesn't matter whether or not we get a kinder, gentler Bill O'Brien, because Democrats are going to run against him as kind of the embodiment of all that's wrong with the Republican Party. And it'll be a useful fundraising tool for them. It'll serve as a way to kind of motivate the base to turn out in 2016. So, you know, we may see a different version of him. Maybe, maybe not. But again, from a political perspective, it almost doesn't matter because he's become this kind of shorthand caricature for all the sort of extreme elements of the Republican Party. And it's hard to undo that after the number of years that it's kind of been part of the discourse.
Kathleen, and then I have another question for you, Jonathan.
Yeah, and I just wanted to add quickly that, you know, we know Democrats are already ready to go to make him this kind of boogeyman for the 2016 election. You know, just days after the election, Democratic Party Chairman Ray Buckley said to me that if Bill O'Brien became Speaker again, it would be a great thing for the Democratic Party's fundraising apparatus. So they're not all upset about this.
Well, and Jonathan, I remember from Mr. O'Brien's last tenure that he picked and chose the media outlets that he wanted to talk to. He was generous with his time with us here at NHPR. He did an interview with WMUR after his selection, but other media outlets were shut out.
Sure. I think it remains to be seen whether we are going to have a kinder, gentler Bill O'Brien. People may recall back in July 2012, he famously or infamously locked out or banned the Concord Monitor reporter Anne Marie Timmons from attending a press conference. And she, heads up reporter, took out her camera and recorded that. And so, you know, there she was at the door saying, "You can't come in." And that was a spat that he had with the editorial department of the Monitor. So when we heard, you know, we have a more open, you know, Bill O'Brien this time, we've reached out to him. We've called him. We've emailed him. And so far, we have had no luck. So I'm not sure if those grudges still hold or if we are going to see a more open Bill O'Brien.
Well, turning from statehouse politics to the very important issue of how many Granite Staters will stay warm this winter, we're going to talk now about Fred Fuller Oil, the company that filed for bankruptcy last week. And this week, a possible buyer stepped forward. Joining us now with more on that story is Dave Brooks, a reporter for the Telegraph of Nashua, who's been following this. And Dave, thanks for your time.
You bet.
Well, just remind us first, Dave, how big Fred Fuller is. This is a story that affects a lot of people.
It affects a lot of people. He used to be a lot bigger before all the problems came up this last winter. He was generally considered to be the largest independent oil delivery system in the state, with tens of thousands of customers. These are private companies, so they don't release that kind of data. But as you remember, last January, all of a sudden everybody, you and us and everybody, every media outlet suddenly got swamped by people saying Fred Fuller's gone out of business and I can't get my oil done. And he hadn't gone out of business, but his phones weren't working and he wasn't making deliveries, automatic deliveries, and there were all sorts of problems. The state had to step in. They set up a hotline. And it was a big problem, and it has produced changes in laws, and most recently it has produced, as you've said, a bankruptcy filing by Fred Fuller, and now a New Hampshire-based company says they want to buy it.
Well, and what surprises me about this story, Dave, is that Fred Fuller served so many people for so long. I mean, how did it end up going into bankruptcy? It all seemed kind of sudden last winter.
Well, yeah, absolutely. And that was one of the things about the story is he had incredibly devoted customers. I mean, people called up and said, I've been a Fred Fuller customer for 40 years, and he's always been wonderful, and I love him, and all of a sudden I'm out of oil. So that was kind of what made the story so poignant. And it's hard to know. The company has had some issues, and the man himself has had some issues. He's had some sex assault claims. He's had some IRS liens on his personal property, and that may or may not have contributed to it. But it was pretty obvious from the start that despite the phone problems, this was a cash flow issue. Oil delivery takes a lot of cash moving through. You have to go down to the docks at Portsmouth and buy oil pretty much every day in the wintertime for tens of thousands of dollars at a time, take it and deliver it to customers and wait for them to pay you. So it's easy for companies to get stuck if they don't have the money set up right, and that has happened several times in New Hampshire's history.
Okay, so you got to have a lot of cash on hand, so to speak,
you
if you're waiting for folks to pay you. Well, as you said, Dave, this week a buyer did step forward. Who was it, and what are the hopes there?
Rhymes, R-Y-M-E-S. We have always want to spell it with an H, but it doesn't have one in it. It is also a family-owned New Hampshire company based out of, started in Antrim, actually. Now they're in Concord. And they've offered to pay $10 million. The U.S. Bankruptcy Court judge on Monday will hear the case. The expectation is that the sale will be allowed. And for the customers, the big thing is that Rhyme says they will take over the pre-buy. There's 22,320 people who paid Fred Fuller in advance for oil this winter, paid a total of $5.7 million. And the fear was they were going to be left out in the cold, quite literally, if Fuller went bankrupt. Rhyme says they will cover those, as well as people who are on budget plan. And there's a total of about 30,000 customers, plus or minus, that Fuller has. So it's a lot of people, a lot of homes.
And the Attorney General's office is watching this.
They are indeed. In fact, I think you can give them a bit of a pat on the back for making sure that Fuller didn't just go under and strand people, as has happened several times in the past. They've been really riding herd in this. Not everybody is a big fan of the way they've done it, but if all goes through as it seems like it will, nobody will be left out in the cold, which is what has happened before.
Well, given the weather forecasts and given what happened in upstate New York this week with the weather up there, that's good news. Dave Brooks, thanks again for your time. We appreciate
it. You bet.
Dave Brooks, reporter for the Telegraph of Nashua, updating us on the possibility of a buyer for Fred Fuller Oil. One of the headlines that we're covering on the Friday New Hampshire News Roundup, 1-800-892-6477, is the number for you to join us with your questions and comments about some of the headlines that caught your attention this week. You can send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org, or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. And Dean Spiliotis, Kathleen Ronayne, Jonathan Van Fleet, returning very quickly to the State House again. And Jonathan, it's budget season. Just remind us what this is all about, why agency heads are going to the legislature and saying, I need X million to do such and such.
Okay. They are all basically putting forth their first budget request of this long state budget process. The governor has already asked them to kind of look at their requests a little bit more carefully and come back with lower numbers. And she kicked off this three-day session by saying, we still have a long way to go, and this is going to be, the state is recovering from the recession, but, we're not there yet, and this is going to be a very difficult budget season.
So she presents her budget in February, Kathleen. So now's the time for agency heads to say, hey, could you please put in this amount for me?
Yeah, this is basically when they show us, I guess, their wish list, if you will. They come forward and they say, here's how much money we need to maintain what we're already doing. So they have their maintenance budget, and that usually goes up a little for inflation or other reasons. And then they have their change budget, which is additional money that they want for new things. So it's really these hearings. I mean, they're pretty short, you know, 15, 20 minutes. I think some of the bigger agencies, you get maybe a little bit longer.
Well, it's not long for these agencies.
No,
huge.
And it's a chance for them to present what they're looking for. And it also shows us kind of their priorities and also the problems that they're facing. So we have the Department of Corrections came forward, and they're looking for about $47-48 million new dollars because they're saying that they're incredibly understaffed and their workers are overworked. It's causing physical strain. It's causing mental stress, emotional stress on these workers, and they need more people in there. So they have right now, I think, 65 existing positions that are unfunded. So just 65 people, they don't have working for them. So it's causing forced overtime on people. And they brought this problem forward and they said, we really, really need to tackle this. Not only do we need to fill those positions, but we need 81 new positions in our new women's prison to make sure that we're managing this properly. And that prison's supposed to open in fall 2016. So it's a chance for them to really kind of lay out the priorities. The community college system, they asked for an additional $3.2 million annually solely to lower tuition per credit hour.
Yeah, and they've been cutting back at NHTI, I think, in Concord has had
some
cutbacks.
And they have to, you know, they're specific. And one of the things that all of the agencies do is they also present ways that they've become efficient over the past 2 years. So it's their – I think they're required to do so, or at least it's unspoken because they've all done it. And they basically – it's their way of saying to you, listen, we've thought long and hard about how much money we actually need, and we've cut back here, and we've cut back here, or we've consolidated here. So these are pretty comprehensive, if short, presentations. And the governor and her budget team, they use all of this information to put together their first budget that, you know, she makes this big address in February, then it goes to the House, then it goes to the Senate, then they have many long nights trying to work out a compromise that they can sign by June 30th. And that's the budget that will run from July 1st, 2015 to June 30th, 2017. So pretty significant. It's going to be the big story of next year. And we know Bill O'Brien's first tenure, a lot of it was marked by budget cuts. And he became this face of budget cuts and Republicans saying we're facing a deficit. And I think we're going to see kind of those battles play out again.
Jonathan, and then Dean, I have another question for you. Yeah,
sure. One of those cuts was to the university system of New Hampshire. They lost half of their funding, 49% of their funding. And so this budget season kicked off with the university system of New Hampshire, UNH President Mark Huddleston coming before them and asking for another $57 million over the next two-year cycle to freeze tuition for in-state students again. And, you know, that's that to give you a scope, that's a lot of money. A lot of these departments are coming in for asking for a lot of money. And the context there is New Hampshire once again has the highest debt load for college graduates and the lowest support for higher education of all the states per capita.
And we seem to bounce back and forth between second highest debt load and highest debt load. And we're back at number one.
Yes.
And that came out this week. What are your thoughts on this whole political process, Dean Spiliotis? So this kickoff of budget season.
Yeah, I mean, it really is one of kind of the central political aspects of the legislative process. I mean, there are so many moments in which this can be used by both sides, as political fodder. You know, one of the key things that Governor Hassan ran on this past election was this bipartisan budget agreement that she had with it. The Republican Senate approved unanimously. There is an expectation people are going to ask for money. You know, you have this wish list of almost $13 billion in program spending. It's a 20% increase. That's not likely to happen. We saw this moment this past spring where Governor Hassan had to put a freeze in place. My sense is if Bill O'Brien is more focused this time as Speaker, we're going to spend a lot of time talking about these budgetary issues and kind of the thing that goes along with it, obviously, are revenue, so business taxes in particular. So this really is kind of the centerpiece of the whole political process in a way in terms of legislative outcomes. And we're going to be talking about this all the way really until next June.
Kathleen.
Yeah, and I think we're going to continue to see kind of this political back and forth. You know, Republicans come with this approach that we have the revenue we have, we need to spend within our means, and Democrats tend to maybe want to find ways to collect more revenue so that maybe we can spend more. And I think we saw that in Governor Hassan's first budget. As we all know, she put that casino, $80 million worth of casino revenue in there, hoping that she had the right environment, that they were going to get that $80 million, and they were going to be able to use that to help fund some of the things that were cut during the O'Brien budget the session before. Whether or not she's going to put a casino in again, she has not been specific. She's been directly asked, and she's not been specific about what she's going to do. I would say it's probably less likely that she's going to put it in there. She probably learned the first time, and talking with lawmakers, the environment is much less ripe this time around for a casino than it was last time. But I think we're just going to continue to see people trying to really simplify the budget process into Republicans saying, you know, you're overspending. We need to spend within our means. We only have so much revenue. And then the Democrats saying, well, if you hadn't, you know, cut business taxes or done this, then we would have more revenue. And it's all about revenue and spending and this kind of back and forth that they will have always had and will just continue to have throughout the process.
Well, and of course, after the election, Massachusetts came out in favor of casino gambling, and they're moving ahead with their new casinos there, so that may have an impact on what happens in New Hampshire. Very quickly, and then we'll talk a little bit more after the break, but Jonathan, a new study came out just this week on the economic impact of substance abuse. What did it find? This was a huge deal.
Talk about a lot of money. So $1.8 billion was the billion with a B is the impact of substance abuse, whether that's prescription drugs, alcohol, all these things. That's lost productivity. That's treatment. That is criminal justice system. You know, in the study, it's interesting because people have been talking about the prescription drug abuse problem as an epidemic for a long time, and everyone gets that, and it affects a lot of people. But when you put it into dollars, then all of a sudden people go, wow, maybe something needs to be done about that. And I think that was the goal of the study, is to put this problem in a different context to maybe move the needle a little bit.
Yeah, Kathleen.
Yeah, that just reminds me, speaking about the budget, when the Department of Corrections presented their budget, they talked about how even with the new women's prison, which has 224 beds, they're worried that they might not have enough spots because the female inmate population is going up. And some of the lawmakers asked why, and they said, a lot of it is usually drug-related crime. So we're seeing the kind of impact that has in terms of how many beds we have and the amount of money the Department of Corrections spends.
Well, we're real interested in this study, and we'll probably be following up with a whole show on this. So I'll leave it there for now. You can join us with your questions and comments for the Friday New Hampshire News Roundup, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Back in a moment. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. It's the Friday New Hampshire News Roundup today in The Exchange. And let's hear from you, your thoughts, reactions, comments, questions about some of the big headlines that we're covering this week. 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. Find us on Facebook or Twitter or send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Our guests for the roundup are Kathleen Ronayne. She's with the Associated Press. Dean Spiliotis, author of the website nhpoliticalcapital.com, and Jonathan Van Fleet, politics editor at the Concord Monitor. And here's an email from Jordan in Auburn, folks. He says, I heard and read on NHPR that a study completed just recently shows that a commuter rail from Boston to Nashua and finally to Manchester would be worth it. Jordan says, any chance we'll finally have an alternative to the I-93 traffic that also happens to be eco-friendly? You're right, Jordan. There was a big meeting about this in Nashua, right, Jonathan, just last night?
Sure. Rail is incredibly popular in Nashua. And so, of course, they're going to talk about rail. It's a packed house. And the information presented last night says that in order to build this capital corridor that coincidentally doesn't make it to the capital according to this plan and terminates in Manchester is about $246 million. And, you know, here – this is an interesting thing because – in southern New Hampshire, people badly want this thing for economic development reasons, to attract new workers, to attract new companies to the state, and also for the commuters that are heading south to Boston every day. And so there seems to be a political opposition to the subsidy that it would cost to create this rail line. But, you know, there's a real disconnect from the population who badly wants this.
Yeah, so packed meeting last night. And I just wonder, Jonathan, we sometimes hear about this in terms of, you know, Democrats tend to support it. Republicans tend to say it's too expensive. Not enough people will take it. In Southern NH, in your experience, you used to work for the Telegraph of Nashua. Is this a partisan issue? Or does everybody pretty much want this thing?
Well, I feel that pretty much in Southern New Hampshire, you know, for the economic development reasons, to attract the tax base, to attract new workers, you know, that really advances the state's base of workers. You know, there's all this reports about outward migration of young people. There's a belief that rail will improve the state's economy. It'll improve its tax base. So I do think it goes across party lines. However, the state's executive council has now kind of tipped back to the Republicans, and the person who took Deb Pignatelli's seat is Dave Wheeler, and he has been against rail. He, in fact, voted against the grant that would have allowed this study to go forward. He's back on the executive council. So the fate of this project, you know, in some ways remains to be seen with the breakdown of the executive council now.
Well, it is interesting. We don't talk about the executive council that much, but every once in a while, this group that approves contracts and big projects like that does have an impact. Dean, your thoughts very quickly on rail. I heard more about rail in these midterm elections than I have in a while.
Yeah, I've noticed over the past 5 to 10 years that opposition to new rail projects has become a litmus test for conservatives. They argue that you know, these systems aren't self-sustaining financially. They require a lot of taxpayer subsidization to work. And there's also this element of you know, the government telling people to get out of their cars and ride on rails. So sort of a libertarian aspect of not being forced to ride trains, and basically the money should instead be used to fix and expand the fraying road infrastructure. So it's become a big political issue. I don't see a lot of Republicans supporting it. At a minimum, at a maximum, I see a fair bit of scorn from some conservatives about the idea that rail is the answer to our travel problems.
Again, the exchange number is 1-800-892-6477. Email us like Jordan did. Jordan, thank you for that one. The address is exchange@nhpr.org. exchange@nhpr.org. Give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. You can find us on Facebook or Twitter, too, if you'd like. Well, and Dean, I did want to follow up quickly with you on a solar energy story out of Peterborough, New Hampshire, where a big solar panel project is in the works, the biggest apparently in the whole state.
Yeah, this is interesting. You know, we've spent a lot of time on the roundup talking about how difficult it's been for these alternative energy projects to get approval. There's often a lot of community opposition. This is in one case where it seems to be going through. There's going to be a 944 kilowatt project on 5 acres at the town wastewater treatment plant. The Peterborough got a $1.2 million grant from the Public Utilities Commission, and they've signed a 20-year power purchase agreement with Abrego Energy. So they think they're going to save about $25,000 a year in powering town buildings and the water treatment plant. So, yeah, it's an example of where alternative energy is going to serve a community. But as we've noted in a number of weeks, a lot of times, particularly for wind, these alternative projects are difficult without community support and without some sort of subsidy to help pay for the initial cost.
Yeah, and this did get a subsidy, as you said, or a grant, so to speak.
Right.
And I wonder, Dean, if you don't need to comment on this now, but if solar is a little less controversial than wind, you don't see it.
Visual
as
impact.
Much.
And here we're talking about at a wastewater treatment plant. So just it's
there's
just
something
not
there
as
already.
Yeah, it's already there, and solar panels can be put, you know, not too far off the ground in an open space.
All right. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. Back to our listeners. Jim's in Nashua, where we were just talking about the big rail meeting last night. Go ahead, Jim. You're on the exchange.
Hi, thanks very much. I was an attendee last night. I came up to go to it because I'm very interested in that subject. And I was listening to the debate about who's likely to support it, who isn't. I must say there's tremendous support in Nashua for it. But one of the comments about the recent election and libertarians, I consider myself to be fairly libertarian. And I don't see the problem with rail as being forcing people into rail as opposed to out of their cars. I think it means making a choice. I think that, to me anyway, that's actually another choice. That's a more libertarian position to oppose it. So I don't know. I just wanted to share that thought with you.
No, Jim, it's great to hear from you because we were talking about this story. So I'm glad you called. So the costs are pretty big. The concern has long been that not enough people would ride it to make it worth it. I just wonder, again, from your libertarian perspective, what you think about that.
Well, I was looking at the numbers last night, and I know from experience that forecasts for rail projects in the United States tend to be very low initially because we have so relatively little rail service compared to, say, like Europe or Asia, that it's hard to get a valid statistics. And so the consultants typically are very conservative in what they propose, what they predict. And the proof of that, of course, is over in New Hampshire, the Down Easter, which goes from Boston through New Hampshire to Maine. The original projections were that it would be X, and it's been something like 6X in terms of ridership. So,
yeah, a lot more than people expected.
Way more than expected. And the benefits to the various towns along the route that have the service have been tremendous. The downtowns in Saco, Maine, and other cities along the corridor where there's stations, these were really neglected mill cities, and New Hampshire has its share of that issue too, and they're blossoming.
Did this come up last night, the success of the Down Easter?
Yes, so a couple of people did bring it up. They said, you know, what are we waiting for? You know, the numbers are much, much better than what these predictions are. You have to hand it to the consultants. They have to be careful because they don't want to overrepresent something as they have.
Okay.
But they tend to be too conservative, in my view.
Well, Jim, good to hear from you, and thanks for calling in.
You're very welcome.
All right, bye-bye. 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Here's another one on rail from Sarah in Concord. She says, to Dean's point regarding being, quote, forced to use trains, one could argue that many of us are being forced to use cars with the lack of viable public transport. Dean, go ahead.
Well, I think those are both good comments. I was very interested in Jim's call. I have to tell you, this is an issue I've followed very closely over the years, and I consistently hear from conservatives and from libertarians, Jim obviously accepted, that this is a subtle means of the state redirecting resources away from roads and bridges and the ability of people to have a good commuting experience towards the sort of democratic progressive notion of community and everybody riding trains together and reducing pollution. It is one of the key caricatured arguments out there in this debate. And certainly there are libertarians who view it as just another choice, but there are many conservatives and libertarians who view it as kind of the state putting its nose where it doesn't really belong.
Well, I'm sure we'll be following up on this study and the further developments of this report as it makes its way through the proper channels. But thanks again, Jim, for that call. You can join us, too, at 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. And all of you, we sometimes like to close out the show on a slightly lighter note. And here's something that caught our attention. Kathleen Ronayne from WBEZ, Boston Television. A Hampton, New Hampshire man was attacked by a groundhog.
Yes, this was
a cute, fuzzy, gentle groundhog.
Definitely a unique New Hampshire story here. And the Seacoast Online also had a pretty good and descriptive story about what happened. So I guess this groundhog is frequently around, this residential property and normally very friendly, say the man and his wife who were nearly attacked by this thing. And it's likely that it had rabies because it got very close. It started trying to gnaw its way inside the house. And ultimately, animal control had to come. But it's just kind of you read the story and it's funny in a way. Imagining kind of this groundhog really trying to come after these people. I think there's a quote from the man that says, I knew that he wanted something. He was out to get me. But that's also really scary.
It is kind of scary.
Really scary. And I think it's also just kind of a reminder that, like, you never know what, diseases or what's going on with wild animals that might be in your yard. So take caution when approaching and dealing with these.
Yeah, the pictures are pretty stunning on WBEZ that the gentleman submitted. You know, again, groundhog, if you saw a coyote, you might worry. If you saw a skunk, you would definitely worry, but usually not a groundhog. And this one definitely, it's kind of sad in a way. It's got a little something going on. I do want to take another call, and let's go to Andy and Bo. Hi, Andy. Go ahead.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to talk about the story regarding the solar installation in Peterborough,
And I think the numbers discussed demonstrate really what is so difficult and I'll say so wrong with some of these alternative energy programs. I think we said there's a $1.2 million grant to do this installation, and the town is hoping to save $25,000 a year. That's close to a 50-year payback with zero maintenance costs and with zero capital costs. 50-year payback, nobody's going to make an investment like that based on common sense or based on economics. So where do we go? How do we make intelligent decisions on something like that? The wind power calculus is similar. Some of those pay back a little faster, but of course you've got the opposition to that.
Yeah, so difficult economics when it comes to some of these projects.
Right, and I'm in favor of saving the environment, but we've got to do it in a way that makes economic sense or you're not going to sell it to anybody.
Andy,
so
thanks.
How do we do that?
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling in. And just in the interest of time, I think we'll have to follow up on that very good point in a later show, focusing just on energy. There are so many energy projects and debates out there that I'd love to just follow up more fully than we can now. So, Andy, thank you very much for the point. By the way, I stand corrected. I said the footage of the groundhog was on WBEZ. I'm such a public radio girl. That's the public radio station in Chicago. It's WBZ television in Boston. So I do stand corrected there. Did you want to comment also on the groundhog story? I mean, we're laughing, but it's kind of sad, Jonathan. And there have been a couple other stories about animals behaving badly.
Well, on a more serious note, I did want to say that I have sources in the groundhog community, and they said that this groundhog was inspired by the Keene State College students.
All right. We'll leave it at that. I did want to ask you, speaking of critters, Dean Spiliotis, New Hampshire's fishing industry, a 75% cut in the cod catch was announced recently. And New Hampshire fishermen, understandably, are pretty upset about this. Can you just remind us of what this is all about, Dean? The age-old question of how many fish there are in the sea.
Yeah, exactly. It's really about kind of the how sustainable the current stock of fish is. And in this case, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration has put a ban on cod fishing in the Gulf of Maine, I think, until next May. And fishermen have been up in arms about this. They say that the administration's estimates of the administration says 3 to 4% of sustainability. The fishermen say this is an inaccurate estimate. And the problem is it will now require a fleet of ships to go further out to sea in order to get the cod, and there are fewer outfits that are capable of doing that. So it's, you know, there's still cod available, but it's going to have a direct economic impact on fishermen on the coast. And it's interesting, and I grew up on a waterfront community on Long Island where clamming and oystering was a way that a lot of people made money, and periodically the government would close the beds down because they were either polluted or not sustainable, and it would have a significant economic impact on a lot of families. So this is sort of a tug of war between sort of larger federal policy designed for sustainability and kind of the economic hardship being borne by certain fishermen in certain communities.
Well, next week on The Exchange, I want to give all of you a sense of what we're up to and then find out what you'll be doing. Granted, it is Thanksgiving week, so I hope that you won't be working too hard. On Tuesday, we're going to dig into what is New Hampshire, and this is going to be really interesting. The findings of a new report that crunches the numbers on everything in the Granite State, from housing to health to demographics. So we've been wanting to dig into this for a while. We'll do that on Tuesday. And then the day before Thanksgiving, we're going to take listener tales of this uniquely American holiday, whether it's traffic and travel woes or how to satisfy a family with 16 different dietary restrictions, ideas about what should be served and what shouldn't. So we'll have some fun with that next week. That's a little of what we're up to. How about you, Jonathan Van Fleet? What are you covering next week at the Concord Monitor?
Well, so it's Thanksgiving week, so we're trying to get a bunch of stories
in the can,
so that people have something to read over their turkey and dinner. And ski areas are opening up this week. Pat's Peak, you know, that's Wildcat Mountain opened last weekend, which kind of threw down the gauntlet among ski areas. It's earlier than ever. They say that the snowmaking conditions have been absolutely perfect.
Well, it has been cold.
And the technology has advanced to the point where they can open, you know, as soon as it starts getting cold. They don't have to wait for Mother Nature. So
wow.
This weekend is going to be a big opening opening weekend for most of the ski areas in
the
state.
Wow, Thanksgiving opening. That's interesting. We were joking in our house that they could take the snow from Buffalo, New York, and truck it to some of the ski areas in New Hampshire. I'm sure they'd appreciate it. What are you following, Kathleen Ronan?
Yeah, so it's going to be a little bit of a slower week at the State House, of course, but that's a good time to kind of dig into some of the bill requests that people have filed for next year. You can
the
already
LSRs,
look at the list of them.
Yes.
Yes, and, you know, there's you got some typical ones, death penalty repeal, et cetera. You have some unique ones like making it illegal for someone to drive with an animal on their lap. So we'll be looking at all of those and what's out there and what our lawmakers want to do next year.
Very interesting. So when we return for the Friday New Hampshire News Roundup, not next week, we won't be here next week with a roundup, but we'll definitely be digging into that over the next couple of weeks. That's real interesting. Dean, how about you?
Yeah, in addition to what Kathleen mentions about the legislative agenda and the evolution of the budgetary politics, I am beginning my my vigil for when former Virginia Senator Jim Webb will show up. He's the first Democrat to form an exploratory presidential committee for 2016. I assume he'll be here in Iowa very soon, so I'm looking forward to seeing him up close and personal.
Before Hillary Clinton.
Yes, the first one he's in there. He's slightly to the right of Hillary Clinton, which will be an interesting change of pace from all the debate about whether or not Hillary is progressive enough.
All right. Well, all of you, thank you very much for being with us, and happy Thanksgiving.
Same to you.
You too, Laura.
The Exchange is a production of NHPR. Senior producer is Ellen Grimm. The producer is Faith Meixel. Our intern is Joanna Albertson-Grove. The engineer is Dan Colgan. And I'm Laura Kanoy.